This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
And I'm very happy to say that today I have Neville Morley, the professor of classics and ancient history at the University of Exeter. So first off, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
And today we're going to be speaking a bit about Roman imperialism. So I think probably the best place to begin is with the beginning itself. Do you mind just explaining a bit of the origins of how the Roman Empire sort of came to be?
Okay, well, it kind of depends who you talk to. If you ask the Romans, what they would say is, firstly, it's because they are destined by the gods to conquer the world. You know, gift of Jupiter, any number of prophecies. I mean, particularly if you go back to Virgil's Aeneid, you're presented with this grand vision of how the descendants of Aeneas will be given empire without limit, etc., etc. So, you know, they've got this sense of destiny. But they've also got a very strong belief, or at least claim, that they never fight aggressive wars. If they go to war with people, it's because they're defending themselves or because they're defending one of their allies. You know, they are absolutely adamant that they're not the aggressors. So there's a phrase applied to this, you know, it's called defensive imperialism. And the fact that they end up conquering most of the known world is almost an accident or a sort of, you know, a reward for their virtue. Now, I mean, there have been historians who would believe this, and we can certainly argue about how far the Romans themselves believed this. It's, you know, it's not a lie. It's not something which they completely make up. They may be a bit sceptical about it, but they are actually committed to not rushing off to try and conquer people without having at least some sort of legitimate excuse. But most historians would say, okay, it's a bit strange that they keep ending up fighting wars with people. It's a bit strange they keep having to be so aggressively defensive. So, you know, what else is going on here? One line of argument is then actually they are being quite deliberately imperialist. You know, they know war is profitable. They know that they will get the booty, they get the slaves, they get the land, and so forth. And we can look at some of their conquests and say, yeah, they've got a pretty good idea that this is going to be, you know, a beneficial enterprise. And so they're looking for an excuse, they're looking for a pretext, they're looking to be sort of invited in by an ally against somebody else, which kind of, you know, gives them the way forward. But on the other hand, some of their wars aren't terribly profitable. I mean, their attempt at conquering Spain goes on for decades and decades, and it's expensive, it costs them loads of men, it's incredibly unpopular. So, I mean, it's possible they started this with the idea that it would be incredibly profitable, and then they're kind of stuck and they just keep doubling down. So other explanations, one is that it's about, you know, the nature of the classical Mediterranean. It is sort of chaotic there. You've got lots and lots of different tribes and states. So it's actually quite easy for them to get sucked in. And you've certainly got people who are allies of the Romans who are actually trying to draw them into conflict some of the time. You know, you bring in the Romans on your side to beat up your neighboring tribe. Now, of course, you know, this can often end up with the Romans coming in and not leaving. But, you know, it's certainly the Romans are not always being absolutely aggressive. And then the final factor is the nature of Roman political life. That, you know, if you are a, you know, a Roman consul, basically you've got a year to make your mark. What you want is a triumph, glory, you know, following the footsteps of the ancestors. You've got 1 year in which you've got an army to play with. So there's a really sort of strong motivation for lots of these people to be looking out for an opportunity. And, you know, we have sort of cases of consuls who are very clearly trying to drag Rome into a conflict so that they get their shot at glory. Or in some cases, you know, you can see that there is a war coming, but there's a very clear sort of driver to, you know, for the individual to say, let's have it sooner rather than later. You know, you don't actually get much kudos from not fighting a war. So it's all of these factors kind of intersecting.
Yeah, you were saying that they always felt virtuous in it. And, you know, when you think about modern day imperialism, it's sort of done under the guise of spreading democracy. Is there sort of a uniting myth or sort of story that went along Roman imperialism that allowed them to feel that it was virtuous?
Not quite in the same way. It's rather, in some cases, yes, they're bringing peace and stability, but mostly they are responding, or they are claiming they're responding to injustice or to somebody else's aggression, or to go in and defend their allies or whatever. And the benefits of conquest are simply, that's what happens when you win. There isn't particularly... they're certainly not spreading democracy. They're not particularly spreading the Roman way of life, or that's something which happens much, much later on. That in most cases, when the Romans take over an area, they sort of leave as much as possible of the previous sort of administration in place. You know, they do empire on the cheap, basically. They don't go in there and, you know, set up a whole state structure and, you know, sort of start... sort of trying to reorganize things as much as possible. What they want is a well-behaved local elite who will keep the peace, collect the taxes, do what they're told, and they can then control territory with very, very little investment. So that's their ideal. So they're certainly not claiming that they're bringing the enormous benefits of Roman rule. Well, it's rather, okay, you get the Romans as your sort of overlords to whom you pay taxes rather than somebody else.
It's basically an agency.
Yeah.
So what would you say are some of the continued aspects that the Roman Empire has continued today? What's the legacy of Roman imperialism?
I think there are two particular things. One is they show you how to be an empire. So kind of, you know, the visual paraphernalia, particularly what they do with the spoils of empire back in Rome, but also the way they then sort of stick up triumphal monuments and so forth in cities around the Mediterranean. You know, that's what an empire looks like. And certainly if we look at, say, you know, sort of 18th, 19th century empires, there is a very, very strong Roman visual presence, you know, all of these triumphal arches. You know, if you're going to celebrate a military triumph, almost invariably, certainly in Europe, you stick up a Roman style arch. So you get them, you know, even in places which were never conquered by the Romans. You can still sort of, you know, go to Berlin or whatever, and, you know, there is a Roman style triumphal arch. So kind of the iconography of empire. And we can see, I mean, particularly sort of 20th century sort of fascist regimes are very, very deliberately imitating Rome as part of their sort of, you know, visual identity, you know, kind of recognizing the Romans are really good at displaying imperial power. But the British do it, the French do it, Napoleon spends a lot of time modeling himself on Roman emperors, so on and so forth. The other sort of legacy, I think, is the idea of empire as bringing civilization, bringing peace. Now, as I said, that's not something the Romans particularly claim themselves. There are some of their subjects who do it. So we get particularly Greek orators giving speeches in praise of Rome. And one of the things they will touch on is Rome has brought peace to the whole area, it's brought stability, it's helped spread the benefits of Greek civilizations and so forth. The Romans themselves don't make this sort of claim. If anything, they criticize it. The famous example being Tacitus, in his Agricola, puts words into the mouths of conquered British subjects or, you know, rebellious Scottish chieftains. You know, the famous, they make a desert and they call it peace line. It's clearly, you know, sort of, you know, mocking the idea that Roman imperialism is such a great thing. And Tacitus also talks about, you know, the introduction of bathhouses and other Roman customs and says, you know, the British called this culture what was actually part of their slavery. So at least some Romans have really got quite a sort of cynical view of the impact of their empire. But for a lot of sort of modern writers looking back, Rome is the perfect example of imperialism spreading culture. So they do have this idea that what the Romans give to the places they conquer is order, government, law, coinage, you know, the roads, the aqueducts. I mean, I don't know how far your viewers will be familiar with the sketch in Monty Python's Life of Brian of, you know, what did the Romans do for us? Oh yeah, you know, don't forget the wine and the schools. And that image of Rome bringing civilization is enormously powerful. And it tends to sort of whitewash the conquests and the slavery and the violent repression and everything else. And that is then taken by a succession of European empires as kind of their model, as part of their claim that they too will bring civilization, they too will educate the benighted natives and so forth. So kind of Rome is this archetypal empire. It's right there at the beginning. It's the one that people focus on. And a major part of it is this sense of empire as something that's benign and progressive. And even if it's not bringing democracy, you can see how, you know, a modern empire can then sort of take that template and add in modern virtues like democracy, like Christianity. But it's the same idea that, you know, the imperial power conquers people for their own good.
And I guess advocates for this contemporarily in ancient world, Polybus wrote very positively as a Greek in the Roman Empire about the wonders of the Roman constitution and things like that, that you did have people in that time period thinking that the Romans were doing better than the Greeks, I suppose.
I mean, that's right. I mean, it's a fascinating problem. Okay, you are a Greek, you've got this enormous sense of cultural superiority, but inconveniently you've been conquered by these, you know, semi-barbarians. How do you then make your way in the world? Well, one of the ways you do it is by accommodating yourself to the new reality. So yes, we've got Greek writers precisely justifying Rome, explaining how, in a sense, it was destined to happen, so they might as well go along with it. And particularly seeing the empire as an opportunity.
So going forward, the concept of the legacy of the Roman Empire today is strong. We're emulating it all the time. So do you think we can draw clean analogies to the past? That, I mean, people love to talk about the end of the American Empire and how that's going to replicate the Roman Empire's demise. I mean, is it fair?
I mean, I think people are always going to draw analogies. It's what people do with the past, is sort of find bits of the past that resemble the present. I think the difficulty really is, firstly, you can always find other analogies, or somebody else can always find other analogies. So, you know, you may think, yes, the Roman Empire is this really exact model for the modern United States. But someone else can say, well, hold on, here are all the differences. Here are all the reasons why it isn't like that. And that's entirely true. I mean, analogies are never exact. you certainly can't say that, you know, there is an objective connection. It's simply you can look at the past and look at the present and think you see a resemblance. I mean, that's really problematic if what you want to do is say, take this analogy and claim that it then tells you what's going to happen. So, I mean, it's the classic example is, of course, with the fall of the Roman Empire. You know, standard claim, what do we know about the Roman Empire? Well, it declines and falls. So you regularly have people, you've got people, you know, kind of at the moment saying, if the United States is Rome, then what we know is it's going to decline and fall. But all that tells you is that you can look at it in those terms. You can always say, well, in other ways, the United States is not like Rome, so that doesn't help. Or you could say, in some ways, it's like Rome, but it doesn't mean it's going to be decline and fall is inevitable. So kind of analogies don't necessarily help very much. And I think almost you always have to be slightly suspicious of some of them. Why is someone putting forward this analogy? What are they trying to do with it? So again, the fall of the Roman Empire one is sort of alarmingly popular with people who are opposed to immigration, who are suspicious of Islam, who kind of don't like foreigners. And you make this claim, aha, Rome was brought down by all of these barbarian invasions, and that's exactly what's going to happen to us. And again, in so many ways, it's not a terribly helpful analogy. And it's one we have to be sort of quite suspicious of.
Now, I often think of the analogies with Rome more in regards to the overarching structure of bureaucracy or concepts of inflation from an economic policy. I mean, I guess people like to see the patterns, as you say, that's what we do, and therefore be able to sort of predict the downside of things like inflation or changing your currencies or overextending military. I mean, there's different types of analogies, I suppose, people like to make.
Yeah, I mean, I think what the past can tell you is something might happen. It can expand our idea of what could be possible. Rather than, I mean, the one thing you would say that a lot of sort of, you know, modern thought tends to do is to make excessively strong, confident claims and to assume, well, obviously, you know, this is what's going to happen. If we look at history, history can say, well, you know, maybe not. What we get, we look at the past, is a sense of unpredictability, a sense of the range of possibilities. So, I mean, I think, yes, we could look at the Roman Empire and see it in as almost a positive way, that they do manage to control very large areas in a fairly light touch manner. On the other hand, they're not trying to do nearly as much as any sort of modern state is trying to do. The debate about, you know, is the Roman Empire sort of undergoverned, has been a sort of standard sort of argument that you have very, very few salaried officials. But you've also got this image of the Roman Empire as, particularly the later empire, as massively over-bureaucratized and overstaffed and so forth. And I suppose what I find is neither of those images is completely true. It sort of, it depends almost what do you assume the correct level of government is, and that's always up for debate. But it can be a good way of thinking about this. And you can think, okay, well, what are the problems in this system in terms of speed of communication, in terms of who knows what, in terms of, you know, where does the power to make decisions lie? Particularly under the, once we get into the Principate, the question of emperors always being sort of torn between, on the one hand, they can't do everything, they can't know everything, they can't control everything. On the other hand, they're very, very nervous about letting anybody else have power. And you end up in sort of something of a double bind. I mean, none of these things tells us how the modern world works. And there are lots of reasons why the modern world is different. But they identify issues in government and administration, which it's worth thinking about. And, you know, sometimes you don't need the historical examples, but sometimes they can be useful as a way of thinking through these sorts of issues. I mean, you know, there's the case always to be made that Rome, compared with later empires, was quite successful at assimilating conquered peoples. There doesn't seem to be an enormous divide between the Romans and everybody else, certainly within a couple of generations. So again, that's interesting. How do they manage that? But it's never going to give a perfect template which we can just take and say, you know, apply to Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever, because there are so many things which are different. So it's a starting point for sort of thinking things through.
And I suppose the other part is that history is just so vast, so rich, that if you wanted to cherry pick and find an example to support whatever cause you had, you probably somewhere. If you tried hard enough.
Oh, that's exactly it. And in some ways, you know, Rome isn't always the best example, but there is such a tradition of looking to Rome that is almost the assumption. You know, if you're going to compare the United States with anything, of course it's Rome. You know, what else would it be? It would be insulting to compare it with the British Empire in lots of ways. You know, even if it's not going to be helpful, it's simply, you know, the classical tradition, you know, the sort of generation after generation looking back to Rome and Greece as, you know, a way of reflecting on themselves.
So if we can't make these comparisons, if these analogies are not necessarily helpful, then why are the classics relevant today? Why should we restudy it?
Well, I don't think they're completely irrelevant. I think they're good to think with. You know, we can sometimes get somewhere in making this comparison, so long as we don't assume that it tells us all we need to know. And of course, also, you know, like it or not, we're dealing with the tradition of people doing this. I mean, I would be very, very happy if, for example, people stopped comparing Donald Trump to a Roman emperor, because mostly I don't think it's at all helpful. You know, in lots of ways, it's a sort of slightly dodgy comparison. On the other hand, it's a fact that people do this. And, you know, part of understanding modern political discourse is understanding, well, how do people talk about this? Particularly, you know, it's not how do specialists talk about it, it's how in, you know, the general, you know, general public, general cultural discourse, you know, Rome continues to be an important model, or this very sort of fuzzy, simplistic idea of Rome continues to have so much power that it's almost we've got to try and deal with it. And I think having a sense of the complexity of historical developments, so the fact that the past and the present are different, is important. Whereas, you know, the thing of analogies, they tend to try to make them as similar as possible. Having a sense of the complexity of events, all of these are really, really important. Now, it's not just about Rome or classical antiquity. You can get this from studying any bit of the past. So I wouldn't claim that the classics have got some special status, except that that's been the traditional recourse for people who want to think about the past. So in a sense, you know, it's a historical fact. We're sort of lumbered with Greece and Rome to a greater degree than with other periods of history or other cultures. But they do provide, you know, powerful images. They provide some really interesting sort of literature, interesting reflections on different sorts of problems. So, you know, to take the cliche, they are good to think with. They're a really useful resource for sort of, you know, looking at that, looking at our society.
Yes, I often tell people that you know, the time period obviously is interesting in and of itself, but the reality is that to be an educated person up until the 19th century, you had to study it. And so, you know, if you want to understand Freud, you kind of have to understand some of the classics from which he draws upon, you know, and all the later subsequent thinkers were heavily influenced by it. So it's understanding that time period sort of extends to a larger section of history and philosophy and art. You know, if you want to walk around the Louvre of the Prado, you're going to have a lot more fun if you know Greek mythology.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a risk of sort of overemphasizing it, which I think as classicists we do. So, you know, we are very, very aware of anything classical, anyone reading classical literature. And I think there's a risk that we sort of overemphasize it, whereas a lot of the time it's just part of the general cultural baggage. If it wasn't the classics, it would be something else. And actually, it's never just the classics. But yeah, I mean, I occasionally think I wandered into the subject by accident, but I've sort of stayed here because there is so much of this sort of influence in different ways, you know, whether it's particular bits of classical literature that have inspired people and they carry on arguing about them, or whether it's this sort of fuzzier idea of what the classics are about or what Rome was like. You know, even if they're only ghosts, they are still haunting us, would be a way of putting it. And, you know, we haven't yet worked out how to exorcise them or, you know, what the consequences would be if we did.
Well, thank you. It's a lot to think about. It's very interesting. Just to finish up then, can you please tell me what are you working on at the moment?
Well, in some ways, I'm doing a similar sort of project, but with the Greek historian Thucydides, who I've been sort of studying for I suppose it's going on for 10 years now. Not Thucydides himself, so much as how people have read and interpreted him, and at the moment, particularly, how he's understood as a sort of a resource for contemporary politics. So the idea that Thucydides almost isn't really a historian, he's more of a political thinker, and he's a really current political thinker who has, you know, important things to say about, sort of democracy and populism and, you know, fake news and the, you know, culture wars and so forth. So I'm looking at how people read Thucydides in this way. But it is also thinking, well, is there a way of doing this productively? You know, can we actually get something useful from Thucydides? Not just, you know, projecting our ideas back onto his work, but is there something in his work which genuinely helps us make better sense of contemporary politics? So...
Does he
answer
the yes or the yes,
or is it not conclusive? Sorry, something's gone terribly wrong with the noise.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me?
I can now. There was very, very odd. You sounded like a Dalek. I don't know if that helps.
Okay, well, if it's sounding okay, I'll just start again.
Yeah.
Okay, the question is, what is the conclusion? Is Thucydides relevant then? Is he helpful in understanding current politics?
I think he is. I think he is useful as a way of opening up problems and questions. Whereas, you know, the tradition has been to say Thucydides gives us the answer. Thucydides has understood the secret of what's going on. I mean, the classic example, have you come across the Thucydides trap? It's an idea developed by an American international relations scholar, which supposedly explains relations between the US and China. Now, it's as a reading of Thucydides, it is very crude. And My objection to it is it wants to make everything simple. It wants to say, okay, this is, you know, Thucydides is giving us a simple principle of how wars occur. Here is this principle, let's apply it. Whereas my understanding of Thucydides is actually he's about opening up questions and identifying complexity and ambiguity and so forth. So I would look at something like the Melian Dialogue as the most famous example, which, you know, traditionally is understood as basically telling us the world is anarchic and nasty and the only thing that counts is power. I don't think Thucydides is saying that. I think he puts those sorts of ideas into the mouth of the Athenians so that they can be identified and criticized. And actually what Thucydides is doing is showing this is how people with power talk and think. This is how the people without power talk and think. This is what happens in this negotiation between them. It's a way of understanding the problems of power and the dynamics of the situation. So, as I say, it's saying the world is really complicated and we've got to try and understand it in its complexity, not by coming up with a sort of, you know, a simple, you know, one-line theory. Again, Thucydides isn't the only person who does this, but I think he does it in really quite a powerful way that sort of catches the imagination and almost forces people to think, if that makes sense.
I'm
studying this and at the same time experimenting with, okay, well, you know, the problem with Thucydides is he's got this unpronounceable name and his book is incredibly long and bits of it are very, very boring unless you like Greek military maneuvers. Is there a way of turning this into something that's more accessible without losing all the complexity and ambiguity and everything that makes it important? So kind of exploring different ways of presenting bits of Thucydides.
And have you had a book recently come out?
I had a book, yeah, last year. It was sort of a general, it was called Classics, Why It Matters. So trying to talk about some of these issues of why do we privilege the classics? Why do we find it so sort of, you know, powerful and influential? Much of which, it must be said, you know, the first chapter is kind of everything that's wrong with classics in terms of its sexism, racism, imperialism, etc. But trying to get from that, which I think we just have to, you know, we have to face up to that, but then trying to say, okay, well, what is it that classics does give us? Why is it still worth studying nevertheless? So yes, that came out last year and annoyed various people, which it was sort of supposed to do. But others seem to find it, you know, kind of useful part of the conversation.
Well, I think it's a good conversation to be having. And I just want to thank you again for speaking with me today. And I'll put links down below. And yes, it was wonderful and very interesting to hear more about Thucydides and the classics and the Roman imperialism.
Great. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.